Hey everyone, you're listening to What Happens to Chiptune. Today's guest is Christoph Richard, a musician and visualist based in Austin, Texas, formerly known as Note and now known as RLC. I've known of Christoph for more than a decade as a person who came up in the New York City Chip heyday with Blip Festival and Pulsewave as a musician, and later as an event organizer with Kicksnare and Low Level. In this episode, we talk about artist identity and how it changes over time, fitting into the New York City chip scene as a musician and organizer, and as always, what happens to chiptune. So hello again. nice to see you. I'm really excited to have you on. I've kind of started my my survey of the like post Blip Festival heyday, pre chiptunes equals win New York City scene, which is a very specific time, I feel like, in chiptune, but it feels very important to me. It's very important because that's kind of like when I was the most active in chiptune, and I was like the most like with it in terms of like following the scenes and, you know, following music and stuff like that. And then after that period, and we're kind of talking like, I feel like 2013-ish to like 2016-17, it was kind of like, you know, Blip Festival was still going, but it was about to end, you know, and then chiptunes equals win hadn't quite gotten as popular as it had. You know, Magfest was there, but it wasn't like the biggest chiptune festival in America yet. So it's this kind of interesting period where I feel like a lot of stuff was happening. It just wasn't quite like making it out to everywhere, but a lot of local scenes were able to sustain themselves. So I feel like it's an interesting part of chiptune history that I'm trying to like dig into. And I do associate you with that part of it. You know, you were kind of big on the chipmusic.org forums like back when that was happening. So yeah, I'm excited to talk to you about all that.
Yeah, totally. Thanks for having me on. I feel very feel blessed to be able to speak with you today. I think it's an interesting time period as we were all kind of like trying to like wrestle with the end of Blip and understanding where chiptune was going to go next. Everyone was having sort of these questions of like, how does the community kind of move on into its next phase when we don't have like this singular kind of grounding moment that everyone can kind of look to as like, this is chiptune. So I think it was interesting to say the least.
Yeah, cool. Well, before we get into kind of what that all looks like, I kind of want to ask you about your musical history and how you kind of like came into following chiptune and making it because, you know, I always kind of feel like it's an important part of people's musical journey is like kind of, you know, chiptune isn't the kind of thing that you stumble on and you're like, you know, it's like, it's either you're really into it or like, I don't know if I want to listen to this ever again. I feel like it's a good thing to kind of start off with. How did you come across chiptune and like, what were you listening to and like following before you found it?
Yeah. So I'd always been messing around with music and kind of recorded audio pretty much as long as I can remember. I was doing the two tape decks thing, like recording into one and playing into the other. So that was like always, there's something that I had a fascination with audio, I would say. And then just played in a lot of bands growing up, just punk bands and cover bands and kind of just enjoyed being in that space. And then as I sort of kind of got tired of punk music a little bit, I was like looking for the next thing. And I remember reading a Thrasher magazine, and it was an interview with Chad Muska. He was a skater at the time. And they had just this whole thing on like his, you know, whatever, typical kind of skate magazine stuff. And then there was a little like kind of blurb in the corner that was like, what are you doing that's not skateboarding? And it was like a photo of him and his like his two Technics turntables, and he's like, I'm like DJing, and here's two albums I'm listening to. One of them was DJ Shadow Introducing, and the other was a Cold Cut album. I think Let's Replay or Let's Play. And I was like, okay, well, I'll just instantly buy those and see what they're about, because I like his skate style and stuff. So why not check it out? And those two albums kind of got me into kind of electronic music, or not kind of straight band music. And then from there on, it was like a journey of making music on my own, getting pirated version of Cubase, and just going down the rabbit hole of all that. And I kind of did that for a long time and just shared no music with anyone. just making music for myself. I was like looking back on some older stuff actually, before this, and I was noticing some like some square wave stuff and some like very sort of like simple kind of almost like pre-chip, before I even knew what chiptune was, kind of sneaking its way into a lot of this stuff. Eventually, I remember hearing Beck released, I think it was two remixes off the Guero EP, and I think it was Bad Cartridge and I forget the name of the other one, but they were just pure chiptune remixes of those two tracks. And I was like, holy moly, what is this? What the hell is this? And it just cracked me wide open. I remember looking into who produced this. It was Pazza, and immediately jumped into Ninjani Discus and was like, this is it. This is like, I can't, I don't want to listen to anything else. I just exclusively like listened to it for a while, and then kind of kept making my own music, kept was dabbling in like circuit bending and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, so I was kind of getting into circuit bending and all that. And then after college, I would say this is probably like 2006. I moved to Japan to teach English as an English as a JET program participant. Which is a program that exchanges teachers. And when I got there was just like, I think just because of the time period, there were a lot of cheap Game Boys. There was a lot of cheap hardware synthesizers in general. There's a lot of FM stuff. I ended up picking up a DX7, a Yamaha CS30L. Like all these were like going for like nothing. And so in my kind of dabbling with all of that stuff, I ended up coming across Analoop and ordered a copy of that, and it was just I think what happened for me there was that I had been messing around with Cubase for so long, and one of the challenges for me was always like the timeline type of recording with like no sync or anything. I'm really terrible when it comes to like the like organizational methods of electronic music, and so I like would always push through it. But when I first got into trackers, I was like, oh, my mind can wrap itself around this. I understand everything that's going on. It's all directly in front of me. It's all visible, and it's very conceptually clear, and it's compact. From there, I kind of dabbled with Nanoloop a little bit. It didn't really click for me. I think like it does for many people. I still love Nanoloop. I still mess with Nanoloop, but LSDJ is really what became the thing that I think I will always make music on. And that's not necessarily exclusively LSDJ, but I mean, of course, we all know about M8 and all that now. But I mean, I guess that's a long. It's a complicated way of getting to your original question of
Yeah, no, I mean, it's the kind of thing where trackers are such like an important part of chip music history, and the fact that you kind of like stumbled onto Nanoloop first is kind of interesting because Nanoloop is such like a different it's such a different workflow that it does kind of require a lot of it makes you think differently about music, and I kind of feel like people who make Nanoloop releases and like do things on Nanoloop it just kind of affects the way that those tracks turn out in an interesting way. And I got into Nanoloop a little bit when I was trying to do a little bit more like live improvisation stuff with techno. But yeah, it is just like it's like, everything is so abstracted in that environment that it you know, you're learning like three languages at the same time. And they're all new. Yeah.
And that's kind of what I like about Nanoloop as well, is it kind of breaks me out of those patterns that I have when I do jump into a tracker environment that I know I rely on. I think to your point though about live, like I think that's what I've always really missed. It's never broken through with me how to perform Nanoloop live, because a lot of what I do with chip music, or what I have done, it's with the intention of being played live. So I think if I could have cracked that, what I do, if I can crack that, then I think it would be a more central part of what I'm doing.
Yeah. You mentioned you were in Japan and you know, messing around with chip music. Were you releasing anything while you were living in Japan, or was that something that you did when you would like moved over back to the US?
No, I was releasing a little bit on like 8BC, as I think we all were, and there was such a vibrant community there of the kind of the 48-hour challenges and all that sort of stuff, that it was just a very welcoming, I think for a lot of people, not for everyone, was a very welcoming, because obviously it's an internet it's an internet forum, so there's always going to be some sort of toxicity somewhere. But it was a great. I'd never been part of a community like that before. As I mentioned, my earlier music was all really just me in my basement, kind of making music and sharing it with no one. So it was really motivating to be part of something like that. At the same time, I was still making that kind of like circuit. I don't even know what to call it. It's like electronic folk rock with circuit bent stuff
in it. The genre that everyone knows. Yeah,
right. The classic. I'd been making a bunch of that, and I had come across. So I another English teacher there. We ended up talking at a party, and he was trying to get rid of his DX7, and I was like, I will buy that from you. And he was also like, oh, you should meet my buddy. He has a record studio, or he has a studio in a town like an hour and a half from you. I'm sure he would love to hang out. So he introduced me to this guy, Akahiro Nakatsubo. He goes by Fishtone. He had a studio in Tomakomai, Japan, and we started chatting. He was like, oh, like, show me some of the stuff you're doing, and I kind of played him some of it, and he was interested in releasing it. So I ended up releasing an album with him on his label in I honestly don't know, probably 2008. And at the same time, I was like, hey, I'm also doing this stuff on like Game Boy, if you're interested in releasing any of that, like, what do you think? He was like, oh, that's pretty cool. Like, I know a guy who's also doing some of that, but that's not really for my label. We don't really do chiptune. So I was like, cool, that's fine. No worries. But he ended up inviting me to perform at a show in like the last few months that I was in Japan. It was in Tomakomai as well, and it ended up being my first chip show. It was I shared I shared the lineup with Blasterhead, rest in peace. It was incredible to see him perform and be like, how am I on the same lineup as this like legend of like chip break, like what the hell. So that first show ended up being my first chip release, Raibu 908, which was just a recording of the live show. And then from there I was back in the States basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of interesting that your first chip release was like a live show recording. I think that's something that was really it was really palpable at the time, kind of, yeah, like leading up to that, like, early 2010s, mid 2010s situation, where I feel like once it was established that chiptune was the kind of thing that you could perform, a lot of people started focusing on that as like the thing to do, you know? And I feel like before, chiptune had always been like, you performed chiptune and then you recorded and released tracks, right? But it was the performances were always like, I'm just going to play the songs that I recorded and released. And it was never like, I'm going to kind of craft a performance around these Game Boys that was like really cool and like interesting and something that you could only get in a live performance. And I think that that's something that like really characterizes a lot of the mid-10s chiptune, at least New York scene, where there was a lot of experimentation and a lot of like curiosity around what the bounds of like a live performance looks like with chiptune. So you know, that's cool to hear that you were doing that already with like, you know, recording a live set and just like that's the first chiptune release that you put out.
Yeah, I think honestly, like, and I have to give a lot of credit to Little Scale, because I got a Little Scale save file, that basically showed me that kind of like the island organization. I don't know if that's a good way to describe it, but for LSDJ files, which allowed you to kind of like play the file live or be more kind of actively involved in the playing of it live. And I think that is the moment where I was like, oh, this is what I want to do, and this is how I know how to play this live. I don't want to do just like the you know, nope. I mean, I don't know. Some people want to go up and just press play, but it for me, I've always been a drummer, and like I've been in a lot of bands that that are really heavy on improvisation and kind of like listening to the audience and all that. So without that relationship to the performance, it's like not. It wasn't something that I found myself like super energized by. But when I saw that save file, I was like, this is it. I know how to do this. and once you get the link cable involved, it's just like, okay, here it is. And that was, I mean, and pretty much the first set I played was my setup for until like 2016 or 18 or something. It was the classic setup. But yeah, I think it is interesting that especially with, you know, hearing your conversation with Dub Mood about here with how there was that wrestling with like, why would we play this live? You know, like why would we do this on a stage? And then there is a big paradigm shift, I think, when there is that realization that it's fun to play live, and it's exciting to, you know, for everyone, for the artists, for the crowd.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a certain kind of like, you know, apologies for using the term, but like kayfabe around playing live with chiptune, where like at some point the absurdity of bringing a Game Boy or like a computer onto the stage stops being absurd if you buy into it enough, and I think that like that was the sacrifice that the first chiptune performers made so that the rest of us could like actually start experimenting and do interesting things with it, right? Like they took the embarrassment hit so that we could continue and like to figure things out on our end. I kind of wanted to ask about when you moved back to the US. What was it, just kind of like a something that like living in Japan wasn't something that was going to pan out long term, or like what was the reason for you moving back to the US?
Yeah, I definitely would have stayed longer if I didn't feel pressure to come back to the US to start working on a career. I didn't. So I was an English teacher, and I didn't see that long term as being what I wanted to do. It was sort of like I had gotten a degree in East Asian Studies, and I'd studied Japanese. So I wanted to make sure that I like took advantage of that and like spent some time in the country that I'd been studying. I was living in Hokkaido, super super far, kind of north, snowy, and it was lovely, beautiful. But I think, if I was to stay in Japan, I would have wanted to have moved to another city. And And again, yeah, the pressure to start working on a master's degree, all of that kind of, I made the decision to head back to the US, even though I would have stayed, I would have liked to. But I think coming back to the US was also exciting, in the sense that I had been part of those online communities that and I had seen everything that had been going on in New York and was like really energized by a lot of that. So, moving back to the US to New York just felt exciting, right? It felt like there's stuff going on here. There's a community that I've been part of online that I can now potentially be a part of in person. So yeah.
And I mean that it is that the career thing is always a thing. That's always a because it was one of the reasons why I kind of like, because I would have been content, and I wasn't even, I was just in San Diego, right? I wasn't like living in Japan, but it was like one of those where it's like, I mean, I could just keep doing the chiptune thing, and like it was fun and it was cool, but also like money is important for people to live sometimes. So yeah,
Survival.
it Yes. So yeah, that there was that pressure there. And then I guess for me, it kind of ended up being like, how do I like reconcile these like two interests, like these two things that I have that I'm holding in my head that feel like they should be more related than they are, but they aren't. Like I was working or trying to work in the game industry, basically my whole life. And so it was a little bit of like a I feel like there should be more room for like someone like me to exist in the game industry, but there kind of wasn't. And then, with the chiptune thing, it's like, oh, there should, I feel like there could be a little bit more experimentation, or like a little bit more like fun creative stuff with like integrating interactivity and stuff like that into chiptune sets and things like that. But it was just like a little bit tough to figure out while I was also trying to like find a job and all of that. So you moved back to New York, and what were you, did you like get into a school, get into a master's program in New York, or was it just like somewhere that you were interested in living?
I had lived in New York in 2002 for a year, and a lot of my friends had ended up kind of migrating to New York over the span of my time in Japan, and I just felt a draw to New York City, I think, as a lot of people do. It's romanticized, and I don't know, I knew it was the place I was going to end up. So I moved back and spent about a year working in restaurants. And then was accepted to Pratt Institute for a master's in interior design, and ended up doing that for 3 years, and then pretty much hopping right into to the field. But it was really nice to be able to finally kind of like make like physical connections with all those people that I had met online. And it was pretty much like right away, I think I played a Halloween open mic like weeks after moving to New York or something.
Wow, yeah. The was that the infamous Pulse Wave ones, or the,
I
oh
honestly
no, Pulse
can't.
Wave, they're Halloween. I don't know if they do open mics for their Halloween shows, but anyway, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I honestly wouldn't even remember that it was a Halloween one, except that I did I wore a costume, because I did the opening theme song of David the Gnome, and and put on like a beard and whatever. But yeah, and then I think like almost, not short, like shortly after was the infamous Bell House blip that got snowed out. And it was just like, yeah, it was just meeting everyone and kind of and being amazed at how friendly everyone was and receptive and how much energy there was. It was.
And so like you, I guess you could consider yourself as like already having had a presence in like on the internet as a chiptune artist as you were moving to New York. And so you kind of mentioned that it was really, everyone was pretty friendly toward you and like pretty welcoming. I wonder if you can speak more a little bit to like the process of just like, going into a scene that you had you knew about, like, and kind of like integrating yourself in there? Like, was it a situation where you were just like going to shows? Were you like reaching out to people to play? Like, you know, because for me, I've never really like I've never really been a part of a scene that was like really, really like self-sustaining and really active. For like, I've never been able to kind of like go into one as it was happening. Like, it was always, we had to try and build it up, or I showed up too late. So yeah, I'm kind of curious as to like what it felt like to like get into something like that.
Yeah. I think, one of the things that, maybe like unintentionally made it easier. Actually, I don't know if this was really too much part of it, but so because I got that save file from Little Scale, I was always including save files in my releases. And I think almost like the first time meeting several people, they were like, "Oh, your note, I have your save file. Thank you so much for releasing that." Like, it was so helpful to like hear the music and see, you know, see how it was all tracked out. And like, I wasn't doing anything particularly interesting or revolutionary, but I think that kind of, that aspect of like sharing knowledge and, it almost creates like a little bit of more of like an intimate relationship before you even have one. That's not necessarily fair, 'cause you don't actually know the person, but it feels like you've shared something, I guess, in a way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's fair. Like, you know, it's like, I don't know. It's like being able to read a diary entry before you, like, before you meet the person. Right. Except it happens to be all in like hexadecimal and like only makes music, but you know, like because you know, the way people organize their save files is like this weirdly personal thing, even though the tracker is like this overarching structure. I do feel like there's a lot of like different little nuances and like things that kind of expose people's personalities as you delve into something like that.
Totally. Totally. Like, how, like, why, like, I love going through and being like, why did this person highlight certain patterns and all that? Like, it is pretty, I guess, I don't know if intimate is the right word, but I mean, it's like, yeah, like, thanks for sharing your live journal with me before, before meeting. So I think that, like, but yeah, there was that. And I think just, again, the scene was very, very welcoming. There was a lot going on there. So it was helpful for there to be regularity and for it to be already established, to be able to just show up and just like see the same faces, have more conversations, introduce, you know, myself. And then I wasn't really asking people to play shows early on. I think it was just kind of by virtue of the fact that I would just kept showing up. that kind of just happened. But again, like shows were very, very regular. There was Pulse Wave, there was IO. I mean, there's less so, there was Control Flow. So there's always stuff going on. Like when people were in from out of town, like I would host them in my apartment, like to give people a place to crash and all that. So it was, I don't know, like it, I really have to just give a lot of credit to that crew for being just so welcoming. And, I don't know if it was because we all had this one chiptune thing to talk about, or if everybody drank a little too much, I don't know, but it was, it felt very, very natural to step into.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem like that's kind of like the hallmark of a healthy scene, where it's like, there are enough events that people don't really need to ask to play. Like that power dynamic is like reversed, where it isn't like the venues that are holding all of the power. It's actually the venues that are like, hey, we need people to play. Otherwise this monthly event that we have to keep putting on, or like this weekly event or whatever, like we're going to run out of people to play it if more people don't show up and get into this kind of thing. So yeah, I mean, and again, that's kind of like what I associate that time in New York with is just like this huge influx of like, you know, it felt like there was going to be some sort of show in New York every week, at least based off of like the 8BC and like chipmusic.org like event situations, right? Where it was like there was an IO, there's a control flow, there's a pulse wave, there's, you know, there's just so much stuff happening. And it was a really interesting way to experience the scene from afar, especially as someone who was like, you know, it's not like we didn't play shows in SoCal, right? Like San Diego and LA had pretty active scenes, but I think the regularity was something that I was always really jealous of. Just be like, oh, you go to this show and everyone knows that it's going to be some sort of chiptune, right? And whereas in SoCal or in San Diego in particular, we were the ones having to make that pitch to people. We were like, okay, we're all just going to like show up in this dive bar, play this like really loud Game Boy music, and the people there are going to be into it or not, right? And New York already had that kind of like relationship established with the audience there.
Yeah, we were very lucky with that. I think there was a time period where there were four shows, including Kick Snare, they all had regular venues, and there was no shortage of artists in New York that were always willing to play. If you kind of zoom out even further, Philly is a very important part of, I think, the broader success of that, because there was also a strong relationship with 8Static, where artists were always kind of going back and forth between the two cities. They're close enough that you can do that, you know, hour and a half by car or take a bus or Amtrak or whatever. There was no shortage of artists. There was no shortage of events, and because of that, I think you just get a natural tight bond to the community, which I understand it can be a little bit frustrating if say you're in SF or you're in San Diego or Southern California, and you're like, damn, why don't we have that, and feeling like you have to build it up, right? It's daunting, I imagine. I mean,
yeah, I mean, especially with the way that it worked in terms of just like the personal stakes that people put to get to the event, right? It's, you know, it's like even going to Philly from New York, you it's like an hour and a half by car, which is like far, but it's not like the whole day just to get to the thing and spend like a couple hours, right? To get to San Diego from LA, it's like 2 hours, and that's like if there's no traffic at all. Like that's if you're like driving in the middle of the night with like nothing happening. And so very often our like 2 hour trips turn into like a 3-4 hour trip. And then it's like, so I'm driving 4 hours to San Diego from LA, and I'm going to play a show that not that many people are going to go to because it's San Diego, right? The club scene was much bigger in San Diego than like whatever chiptune scene we had. Or vice versa, right? And then if you want to like connect with people in San Francisco, then you're looking at like 6 to 8 hours just driving, right? And then public transit is like, you want to take like a 12-hour Greyhound or something, something like that. So yeah, it was just like, it's one of those where it was so interesting to like see the tightness that like a lot of the East Coast had with each other in terms of just like being able to go to, yeah, because like 8Static, of course, and then the Boston 8-Bit stuff was happening as well, and it was like, you know, it just felt like it was this nice cool like blob of chiptune all happening in that like little area,
even up to Montreal too. I mean, Toy Company and that, like we, you know, I think it's probably a little bit closer to where you're talking about, to San Francisco. I mean, 6 hours or so, but still it felt like Montreal was kind of like we were all extensions of each other's, networks. And it felt viable at least to kind of pop between those cities and almost like it's a broader culture. And then there's little pockets where those kind of stay active on their own, but at least to me it felt pretty unified.
Yeah, I kind of want to talk about some of your releases. You know, I think that something I'm pretty sure it was Danelle mentioned, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 as, you know, his personal like I think it's because it's like it's the ultimate like manifestation of Donnell's like theory of public transit makes chiptune happen. But yeah, I mean, you know, like I kind of want to ask you about like the process of writing music on the Game Boy as you're living in New York and kind of like participating in this scene that's like really built out and things like that. Like how did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 kind of come about?
Yeah, I really liked hearing that from Donnell, his whole theory, because it's one that I've thought about quite a bit. There's something important, I think, for me, there was something important about the Game Boy's portability, obviously, its reliability. It's kind of like batteries lasting forever, and it's instant on. All of that, when combined with like, at the time I had a 45-minute commute each way, with like a baked-in like hour and a half of time to work on music, results in like a really great schedule or a great like approach to writing music. At least it was for me, right? It's like you know, if something comes up on the train, you have to make a sudden you know, change or whatever. Boom, it's instantly off, and then it's everything's saved, and then you can just pop it back on the second you're in your next location. But that hour and a half really just I mean, what else are you gonna do? I mean, I guess there are a lot of other things you could read, you could listen to a podcast. But if you're somebody who makes music, it's that one of the hardest things to do is to carve out time to work on it. I think recently, like the last 4 years since I moved to Austin, that has become very evident to me, because I drive a lot here. There's a pretty paltry public transit system, and I find myself not carving out the space to write music, and it's you know, it's a little bit of a bummer, but it does make me reflect on how important that the presence of that is for a specific type of person like me. But yeah, I think that album, it was kind of early in my time in New York. I'd pretty much just moved there, and I was writing the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to Columbus Circle, and it was, yeah, it was just really fruitful. It was a great time to explore things. It was a great time to just write a lot of music, and that's really the product of it. I mean, I always loved this, like, I forget, I think it's a comic, Asterios Polyp, I think. I forget who the artist is, but talks about how there's this one character who was on a road trip and knits a scarf the whole time they're on the road trip, and then that scarf is like a physical representation of the length of time that it takes to get between. It's like actually, you know what? I don't know if it's from that comic, but I may be misremembering this. But I really kind of love that idea of like taking time and transposing it into another medium. And that album really much, very much felt to me like a transposition of the amount of time that I spent riding those trains to that job for 6 months. And it's a great little time capsule of like what I can do in that amount of time and where I was at that amount of time at that time and kind of like my musical explorations and all that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember it having, you know, a pretty good amount of success just like on the broader forum situations that were happening. And yeah, I mean, it is such an interesting thing to think about, where it's like, because music is the medium that feels the most able to do that kind of transposition, right? Like the one everyone associates like the same song with like a different particular like event or time or place in life, because you know, when you come across a song and you listen to it at just like the right time or something, you know, that becomes the memory of, like, when you listen to a particular song that you really love. Like, you know, even with, like, the Anna Monoguchi stuff, like, I my memories of listening to Anna Monoguchi were just, like, you know, putzing around UC San Diego, like, you know, doing things and just kind of, like, realizing that this was music that, like, not a lot of people at this school or in this city had, like, heard before and this and that. And that's kind of what I associate with it. And, you know, I love the idea of, like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 as just, like, a time capsule of, like, that period of your life. Doing all the commuting that you can do. And I'm kind of curious if that, like, progressed into your later releases. Like, I know Axon Music was the kind of thing that, like, really it felt like it was really developed when it came out, and I think a lot of people responded to it as, like, this really interesting and, like, really developed release that wasn't doing anything but just, like, Game Boy stuff. Like, I feel like a lot of people were experimenting with, like, live instrumentations or genre or whatever, like, different ways to do chiptune. And Axon Music felt like, when it came out, it was like, no, this is just chiptune on one Game Boy, but it's like, it feels like one of the more developed versions of that you could get to. So I kind of, like, wonder if that like composition process you had from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like, carried over into Axon Music.
It did. Yeah. It definitely did. I think it shifted a little bit because I entered into the, you know, the field for my career, and so my commute was kind of mixed up a little bit. So I had a bit of a different relationship to, or my writing had a bit of a relationship that had to change. But I think a lot of the ideas that I, like, started in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like, yeah, they were kind of, like, more fleshed out in Axon Music, but to me, Axon Music always feels like a stepping stone to Color Mechanica, which is, like, probably the what felt more like where I eventually wanted to be. And you're right that it includes kind of, like, other hardware and all that. So I don't know if it was just, like, that was kind of me wrestling with not having any money and just being, you know, and keeping it purely Game Boy. But there is something that feels very that I still enjoy about its purity. Not that you shouldn't, you know, obviously I think mixing new instrumentation and hardware and all that is great. But there's something that was, satisfying about kind of working out those ideas that I'd had and keeping it kind of pure.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, kind of, I'm curious about, like, your experience with event organizing as well, because I know that you had a hand in, like, low level and things like that. I'm not sure. Did you work on Kicksnare at all, or was that just, like, was that just something that was another monthly that was around at the time?
That was started by Chris Kaiser and I.
I wanted to make sure that I didn't have it like this totally did. Yeah, because I associated Kicksnare and low level in a similar fashion. And so, yeah, I was kind of curious as to, like, why you felt like you wanted to have add another monthly to the schedule and you know, put a why did you make everyone come out again for No, yeah, but, you know, it's interesting because, right, like, it feels like the scene was so developed and you obviously felt like you wanted to add something to it. And I'm kind of curious as to, like, what that was.
Yeah, totally. yeah, it's a good point that, like, did we really need another monthly? I think it kind of started with, there's an event called Make Music New York, which happens every year, which I'm sure probably still happens post COVID. But it's a you can apply to basically busk at multiple different locations throughout the city. And if you apply, they just kind of you ask for a neighborhood, and they kind of give you a spot to go and play for a couple hours. And I had done it for a couple of years with different friends. And the 1 year they we got placed directly in front of a bar called Branded Saloon. And it was like a Texas themed bar in Prospect Heights. And when we were playing out there, afterwards, they came up and they were like, "This is dope, y'all. Like, this is really fun. You should do a show in the back." And we're like, "The back of what?" So we went to the back of the bar, and there was like this little room that was like, it was perfect. It was like just a goofy little, live music space with like some antler chandeliers. And we were like, "Okay, amazing. Yeah, we'll schedule something for like, a month from now or whatever." So we, Chris and I formed Kick Snare mostly to take advantage of this relationship that we had with Branded Saloon. And I think we similarly had hopes of that a lot of other shows had, which is to like fold in other artists that are not chiptune into a monthly that, because I think a lot of the other monthlies were like pure chiptune generally. And I think for better, not for better, for worse, but I mean, I don't know that we were super successful at it, but nor were we very regular. We weren't actually, we didn't end up doing, they ended up being more like quarterly shows. But yeah, we always tried to bring in somebody else. And it was really, again, just to kind of take advantage of Branded Saloon, which was a venue that loved us. We loved them. They didn't charge us anything to play, and it was just a really fun, weird space, which got very rowdy. I remember when IAYD played, the performance space was kind of like at ground level, and then there was a little basement level where they had some pool tables. I remember going downstairs while IAYD was playing, and watching the ceiling below. From below, like bowing, as everyone was like dancing super hard, and I think somebody got crowd surfed into the antler chandelier. It was great. But I think, like, I guess the bigger point of this is that the relationship between shows and the space is pretty key. I think I know you've. I'm sure you've heard about the trials and tribulations of Pulsewave moving around to different locations, and how big of a challenge it is to kind of uproot yourself and like recreate the show that you love in a new space, and to do that over and over again. So we really just wanted to take advantage of this, the regularity of this space, and they were chill with us until they built an apartment building next door. And actually, this was that IAYD show. We ended up renting subs.
Yeah, that's
And
another uh-oh moment.
yes, and that unfortunately was like the second to last show that we did there. So I don't want to say cops were there, but.
I mean, subs are a very
Yeah.
particular kind of music amplification equipment, so
It
yeah.
was worth it, honestly.
Yeah,
It was
especially for
worth it.
IAYD's music. Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah. I think it was IAYD and Trey Frey, if I
Oh,
do.
yeah. Then,
It
yeah,
was.
the subs are 100% worth it for those.
Yeah. It was. I would never do it differently.
Yeah. And then,
Yeah.
so with that, was that kind of a similar situation with Low Level? Like, did you have that relationship with the venue that you were able to kind of throw Low Level on there? Or is it like a different kind of mission there?
That was a different mission, and unfortunately, and I think the biggest challenges we had were with venue, but that really came from the shutting down of Blip, and the kind of the big monthly shows coming together and being like, we should do something. So Low Level was Kick Snare, Pulsewave, and Control Flow, the all of the was with Jen De La Vega, Dustin Long, Chris Kaiser, and myself. All were like, we got to do something. It was 2014, or we started planning it in 2013, like not long after Blip stopped. And yeah, it was not too much of a challenge to find the original location, mostly because it was like 2 blocks away from my job, and I just walked over there and was like, "Will you host a bunch of dorks?" And they were really happy to work with us. The venue is called Villain. I think they're probably still there, but they were just kind of trying to kick off their I think expanded show offering. They were like a small theater before, I think. But yeah, it was just really like again with kind of a mission of bringing in other artists. We had like the first year we had like Meishi Smile and Slime Girls, and on top of artists like Kovox and Paza and the like. But the mission got pushed a little bit further in 2016 when we had like Ducky and Metamoro and like Ghost Cop. It was like a bunch of bands that I think wouldn't necessarily always be associated with chiptune.
I mean, that was always the most interesting part about low level to me, was like, oh, like this is an interesting perspective for booking, right? For like assembling acts, because like I feel like low level kind of happened. Yeah, it was post Blip, but it was like before the crunch of like people kind of like stopping making chip music, right? So it was really interesting to me that you were like deliberately choosing to kind of like branch out from a chip tune only focus and start bringing in these people that like not weren't just not chip tune, but we're like, DJs and, Meishi Smile, FaZe is like just did her like 20th or 10 year anniversary of Lust. I think she just had her concert like a couple of days ago, actually. So but yeah, Meishi Smile is not, chip tune, right? So it's just like bringing in all of these different people. And there was also that kind of like interesting influx of like talent that I hadn't heard of from the SoCal scene going over to low level as well, right? Meishi Smile being one of them, Slime Girls being another, right? There were all these like really interesting talent, really interesting acts that were kind of like showing up, popping up in SoCal and doing like the California, tours and stuff like that. That it was like, oh, okay, this is like the next wave of it. And it wasn't necessarily like, we are chiptune, we make music on Game Boys. It was going at it with a different kind of vibe in mind, trying to like harness a kind of nostalgia, but not the nostalgia for like specifically a Game Boy, right? It was the goal of their music was a little bit broader than that. And so that's why Low Level was so cool, because it was like, oh yeah, it was like matching that situation as these people are coming up. It felt like it was a festival for like the new wave of whatever chiptune was going to be, this kind of like new, not just Game Boy, not just video game situation.
Yeah, I don't want to give us like too much credit on that, but it does feel like it's a little bit like ahead of what chiptune would become, which is I think like as you mentioned before, like a vibe as opposed to purely like a methodology or anything like that. Like the reason we had a lot of these artists come in is because they had elements of not, I don't want to call it retro, but it was like they were taking elements from what we would consider chiptune, and they were like bringing it into new contexts that felt referential but like very fresh, which is I at the end of the day, I think everybody wants to dance and have fun, and they're there to kind of celebrate this vibe. So why not expand that net to include everyone, which is why, I mean, I think part of the mission with Low Level was to combine music and art, like art installation and games. So it always had to have like those three things coming together to kind of be celebratory of all the different ways in which we can produce exciting, but I guess like how would I like limited or constrained, whatever your constraints are, limited in a way that kind of takes those constraints and makes something beautiful with them. So I think we're lucky to have Death by Audio Arcade help out a lot on the games front, and had some great installations, and like big stuff. I think it was always also important for us to have like big artwork, to be able to kind of interact with and do something that was a little bit more experiential.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just taking a look through the website right now, and it's like one of the first like appearances of Line Wobbler, which has done the rounds. So it was, it was really interesting. Like as much as Blit Festival like was focused on the music and like the workshops all pertaining to like making music in that form, the expansion of it to kind of like this broader interactive art and music festival was, yeah, it just felt like a good like logical step, as a lot of artists were kind of like moving in that direction as well. So yeah.
And I think there's always a little bit of a tension, as we've seen with kind of Magfest, is there's the tension of being getting too close to games, for a lot of chiptune artists. And I think our take was like, these games are new games. They're people expressing themselves through an art form that is as viable as any other art form. I think those should they deserve to be celebrated in a space where, at the end of the day, everybody enjoys most of these things.
And yeah, so low-level is happening, and then I guess we can kind of like move to, because I want to ask about you moving to Austin, but I also feel like it's very like tied into the question of the title question of the podcast, which is what happened to chiptune. And again, I'm doing this preface with like everyone I talk to, but I don't want to be prescriptive with the way that you answer this, right? I feel like it's personal to some people and like very broad and abstract for other people. But as far as I know, you're not releasing like quote unquote chiptune music anymore, right? So I'm kind of curious about like what happened to chiptune with you and like and what and your relationship with chiptune, and then like your thoughts on kind of the broader scene, because you were like an event organizer and you kind of like did a lot of work in that arena.
Yeah, you're right, because it is a two very much a two-part question, the personal and the community. Let's see. What happened to chiptune for me? Well, I think being like LSDJ and the Game Boy format was really helpful for me to basically learn trackers and learn the way that I prefer to make music. And it worked out for a while because it was financially viable. I couldn't afford to own synthesizers and things like that. But it was also limiting. I feel like most of the time that I was using LSDJ live, I wish that I had more control over individual aspects of LSDJ. I always wish I had like individual like volume controls that I could just kind of play on the fly, and an expanded sound palette and things like that. So when it when and I think this happened to a lot of people at for a specific generation of chip musicians who came in at a certain point. It's like you started to make a little bit more money, and you were able to kind of play in the spaces that you weren't able to play in before because of that. So I think from like 2016 on, I was incorporating like drum machines and like little monosynths and making heavy use of the Arduino Boy, and then eventually I was basically just controlling my entire Eurorack from the Game Boy, just because LSDJ was my preferred like writing method, right? And even when I had a NerdSeek in the 7U, like I would still prefer to be on LSDJ because it was just like the muscle memory is just, it's unbeatable. So for me, I think the eventuality would be just kind of sticking with the tracker format and then moving into other ways of making music. And honestly, some of it is coming back kind of full circle to like DJ Shadow, kind of more like sample heavy, turntablist kind of stuff. Not that I'm using turntables, but it's kind of the music that I like wanted to make early on, but didn't really know how to, and followed every rabbit hole I could go down to just make any music. But I think as many people have talked about, the M8 is kind of a sea change in. And I should give credit to the Pollyanna Tracker as well. They are doing a lot to kind of expand the interest in tracker music. But for me personally, it's like I find myself getting more and more back into tracker music because of the M8, because it specifically does the things that I couldn't do with the LSDJ, which like I plug a Fader Fox into my M8 and boom, now I have volume control over all my channels. Hell, I have enough knobs left over for some filters and delay, send, return, and it's like it's now it's possible.
I mean, I do think that there's actually a really interesting like thread to pull on where like is something about a bunch of people making Game Boy music in like the kind of early 10s to mid 10s that all at the same time experience a frustration with like being unable to perform the way that they want to live, right? Because the live performance of a chiptune act was such like a big part of that time, right? It was so like that was the way you participated in the chiptune scene at the time was if you were an artist, you would release music online, but the way that you kind of like made it out there was to go and perform, and the way that people participated with chiptune in the physical sense was to go to shows. So it makes sense to me that a lot of people would like get frustrated with the inability to do more interesting things with performance on LSDJ at the same time that like you're being exposed to like and even like the EDM stuff, right? Like EDM scene was getting like really big at the time. Like the big massive raves in Southern California were getting big, and so you have like the rise of like your Swedish house mafias and things like that, right? Where you see that like your music isn't that far off from what that could be. Like you're like maybe a couple of like degrees removed from, yeah, we're making music that is structurally relatively similar to what is happening in like the EDM like kind of rave space, right? And I feel like a lot of people, some people respond to that with like a kind of like, oh, I want to be pure, I want to kind of keep it to the basics, whatever. And then some people kind of reach for that, right? And it doesn't like, oh, I want, it's not, it doesn't manifest all the time in like, I want to be Swedish House Mafia, I want to be Avicii or whatever, right? But it does like, well, what if I could twist a knob and it would do something on stage or something like that, right? I feel like that kind of like rise and shared element, that shared rise of like both the EDM scene and kind of like chiptune's notoriety in of the era is something that's interesting, and it kind of like resulted in a lot of people attempting to do that kind of thing, and then the chips landing where they may with like whether people continue to do chiptune or they just like, no, I just want to make more music with a different palette at the time.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something there. I think we were reaching like a moment where like people had like dialed chip dance music so well, like your Trey Frey, Mono Deer, like Ultra Sid, rest in peace, like it was so good and it sounded so excellent, and like you could do that and you could keep doing that. But then if you're an artist and performer, I think you're always like asking yourself like, well, I've done that. Like, what else can I do? Like, what's how can I keep challenging myself to introduce new elements or to or to push what I have even further? And I think just the presence of the Arduino boy, like even if you don't use it, like if it's just sitting in a corner, you're like, well, I could always plug you in, and then I do. Like for a while, I was just using the what's the little Korg sampler? Shoot. I'm spacing on it, but it was just like a super simple little Korg sampler, and it just had a high pass and low pass. I was just using it for drums, and the fact that it was just drums in one box with a high pass and a low pass means I could just like take out the kick real quick, and then bring it back in. That alone was like, oh my God. Like from a performance standpoint, it's now way more fun for me to perform, or even more fun. It adds some low end. Like I don't know. You just start to kind of, you're like you said, you're hearing a lot more dance music. It's becoming more kind of part of the zeitgeist. And whether or not you've like fully realized you're doing it, like you kind of wanna. I felt the pull to kind of expand the palette. I think you're right that you saw a lot of people doing that at the same time. It takes, you only need to hear a few super saws before you're like, I want a super saw in in my set. I really want those big those trance stabs. And as much as I love the Game Boy, I can't get it. I'd have to dedicate an entire Game Boy to a trance stab if I really wanted to do that.
I mean, that was my thing was like my trajectory was like, well, I can't make trance on the Game Boy, so I'm gonna explore trance structures, right? This kind of, like these really long songs that like kind of like take a really long time to break down and build up, and you know, what's the climactic moment that I can get with like Game Boys and like use of like some external reverb or whatever, right? That was like what I was doing for the whole time, and then you know the M8 comes out and you can just make a trance stab with like nothing, you know, like almost no effort, and it's like, okay, well, I guess I'm gonna do the other thing now. I'm just gonna start making trance now. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean the M8 is it's pretty incredible.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious. So like you've mentioned that you have all these other synths that you're kind of adding to your compositional workflow and things like that. What like are you primarily just like a synthesizer synthesizer musician at this point, not like a, do you consider yourself like a chiptune artist still, or have you just fully moved into the other side?
Yes, you're hitting on an existential question. that's hard for me. I've always kind of like had a hard time with the term chiptune and chip musician. I don't know if it's just like a personal issue, but I've always liked the tracker music denomination. Is that the right term? Because like it's like the for me the methodology is like the thing that I that is important, and like however that expresses itself is kind of is what it is for the project or the release at the time. But I did struggle with this a bit. I kind of not really sunsetted the Note project, but I kind of like put the Note project to the side for a little bit because I really wanted to try being a musician without the kind of chiptune connotation. And also I've like not ever been like a huge fan of the Note artist name. I think there, this is no shame on people who have names like this, but there's a couple tropes in chiptune naming, using boy and heart and things like that, and one of them is the exclamation mark, and it all came about because like in college my buddies called me Note, and you know, you do think you create artist names when you're in your 20s and you don't really think about it too much, and then and so like I've been like looking for a way to kind of make a break from that. And but it didn't mean that I was kind of changing my methodology. I don't know that I don't actually know how to answer that question. I don't know that I make chiptune anymore. I still have chiptune like releases that I've been sitting on for a while, quite a few years, but that doesn't mean that I won't make pure chiptune again. I still love it as an art form, and I still love the textures of it. And that'll never change. But I think the kind of existential question was like, can I do music? It's actually twofold. Can I do music under a different name and kind of set a new tenor or a new kind of tone for my music? And then also, can I do it less focused on hardware? Because I think one of the challenges that a lot of that I had as a chip musician was always like, oh, like look at this hardware that I'm using, or look at this synth that I'm using. And I think it's very distracting from the music itself, and is a bit of a crutch for myself personally. So I was always curious, like, and I have not succeeded at this because admittedly, like a lot of the, from my Instagram, a lot of the videos are like, oh, it's like here's the M8, or like here's a synthesizer, or here's some Eurorack stuff. And I think I do that while knowing that like it doesn't really welcome new people in, and most people who are going to listen to your music don't really care how you made it. And it can sometimes be distracting to be so heavily focused on like this box that that has a spreadsheet on it, versus just like listening to the music and creating like a visual to associate with it. So, it's I don't I know we talked about this a bit before. I think like there's a lot of like SynthTube has a similar problem, and like I there's if we if it was really about the music, does it really matter how it was made?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I feel like that like kind of showmanship part of it is missing in a lot of those conversations, right? Because it's like at the end, you're right. At the end of the day, like the heads will care about how you made the music, but like, for the majority of the way that people experience music, it's much more of an like of an embodied thing, right? If you're thinking like, oh, well, that person, it looks like the filter envelope is like shorter than, I'm used to or whatever, right? No one it's the only it's the kind of thing that you think of when you're like trying to get stuff for yourself, trying to like get tricks or things like that. But like actually thinking about actually experiencing music is like really an embodied situation, right? So you're dancing, you're the sound is like hitting you in different ways, and you're letting your body like just be exposed to the music, as opposed to like having it all sit inside your head as this like abstract theoretical concept. And I think that was what was so powerful about like the way that people were approaching chiptune, kind of like, yeah, in like as a performance, right? Because at the end of the day, it is just people jumping up and down with Game Boys, but like that spectacle invites people to participate in a similar way, right? If the person playing the stuff is like jumping up and down and doing all that stuff and kind of like being an inviting person and putting their guard down, then I feel like it does invite the audience to kind of do the same. Whereas with a lot of like big synthesizer, a lot of big synthesizer performances and stuff like that is so like guarded, and it's very like down, it's very tame and very like soft and kind of, because a lot of the performance is like making sure that the whole thing doesn't fall apart, right? But the falling apart is often the most like interesting part of a performance, as long as there's like a comfort with it. And so I don't know, I feel like with synthesizer performances, it's a little bit like that's why my approach has been to like strip it back down to two M8s, is because like having a very minimal hardware setup allows me to kind of like participate in the act of performing music in a way that I couldn't with like six different boxes all doing different things. So I don't know. That's kind of, yeah, it's kind of a weird thing to walk through, I guess.
I think you're dead on though, and it does remind me of like when I was just performing with two Game Boys. Again, they're like bulletproof. I don't know how many beers have spilled on or around those Game Boys. Like they still work, right? Like it doesn't, they're still fine, and there's something about the simplicity of the interface where like you can very easily perform it jumping around like a complete asshole, and it like bringing people into the fold with your performance. I think that's such an important part of it. And I remember I played a show at Wonderville, probably would have been like 2019, where it was 7U of Eurorack being controlled by LSDJ, and it was like a pure like techno set. And it was a lot of fun, but I was so worried about the gear that was on stage and like, just, you know, doing the wrong thing and spilling a beer on it or something. I don't know. It was just like, it meant that like my performance was a lot more staid, and reserved. And I think that very much communicates to the audience, to your point. Like it was a lot harder for me to connect with the audience because, and maybe it's just because I'm not well practiced at techno sets or anything like that. It was a little bit out of my wheelhouse, but like, I do think there's something to be said about, the relationship, the artist relationship to the hardware and through that, the relationship to the broader performance and scene. Yeah.
The last thing I want to ask you is, kind of about, you know, where you are right now. You said you moved to Austin, and I'm kind of curious as to, you know, how that affected the way that you made music, the way you think about music. You know, because it's moving from New York is going to be, and moving to New York and participating in New York's music scene is going to be interesting, regardless of what music you make, right? And I've never been a person that was moving away from an interesting, from like, you know, the music scene, right? I've always been like, I haven't moved that much, but like moving to a music scene is something that like I understand, but like kind of moving away from it, that's kind of different. I'm kind of curious, like what that was like for you.
Yeah, it was, at the time, I wasn't really thinking too much about it. I moved in June of 2020. Obviously COVID was in full swing, especially in New York. And I think there was a very palpable sense of fear, obviously, with everything that was going on. And it was pretty much like a fight or flight response, I think. And the last place I'd really visited was Austin, and I was like, oh, that's pretty cool, I'll go there. So I just bought a car and sold half my stuff and just moved to Austin without really considering too much about what that meant from a music standpoint at the time. But yeah, I think there were like in the 2019 to 2020, maybe even before that, I think there was of course a lot of change in the New York scene from the monthlies. I think IO was not really operating anymore. Pulse Wave had lost the space again and wasn't really operating too much. There was definitely a sense of like things were uncertain and kind of chilling a little bit. And I think the assumption was always that everything would kind of come back or find its footing, or, you know, Pulse Wave finds a new spot or something. And I think Kicksnare's last show was 2019 or 2018. I think it might have been 2018 actually. So it as much as it felt like I was like leaving because of COVID, it also felt like the scene was in a little bit of a precarious state. And so many of us had also been moving on to making other types of music, that there was definitely like a trying to figure out how it all works together, and what the future trajectory would be. But yeah, I think being in Austin almost 4 years now, which is kind of remarkable. I haven't had a really good, I haven't been trying really, but I haven't had a good experience with like meeting a new community of people that are making the types of that type of music, and or like the type of community that I had in New York. It's definitely been a challenge for sure. Also taking a like with the like the loss of the digital communities and my own kind of personally taking some time off of social media, it kind of brings into question like, yeah, where does music fit? and like, well, who was it for? And why were you doing it and all that? And that the answer has been, I mean, largely for myself. I still do make music. The M8 again being a big part of it. Gotten into a bit into like visuals with shaders and the like, and been really enjoying that kind of intersection between tracker music and visuals, and it's felt very rewarding. But yeah, I guess it's part of the bigger question of like what happened to chiptune. I mean, there's the personal side and then the community side. Like I don't if there is a community here in Austin, I don't really know it. I don't know if it's just like the general vibe of what the type of music that the city prefers to book. But I also haven't really tried to find that community here and relied mostly on just making music for myself and sharing it with a few friends and yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of in I feel pretty similar actually. 'Cause, like it's just the sense of like I don't know, it's a weird thing because like I moved from San Diego to New York like pretty recently. Like, in the last year, and I imagine making a podcast about chiptune like inspired by a documentary of a chiptune festival in New York, and you think like, oh man, like he must be like going and finding everyone and talking to everyone, and the answer is actually it's actually kind of not been that case. And I don't know if it's because I haven't felt like comfortable here or if I've just been like bogged down with other stuff or whatever, but there is this like a weird sense of like momentum, like having a sort of momentum and then having to reset that and build it all up again once you kind of move into a different environment. And it's something that I've been dealing with as well. I even just trying to hang out with people, I've been like, it's just I haven't hung out with as many people as I want to just because, it's hard to figure out what my schedule looks like and kind of like how far away things are and then, get the energy to do all of that stuff. So it has been kind of a weird experience to like up because when I was living in San Diego, like I lived in San Diego, moved to the Bay for like a while, and then came back to San Diego. And when I did, it felt so familiar to me, where it was like, oh yeah, I know where things are. I know like the people that I'm supposed to talk to. I know, and even when the scene, like the kind of broader synthesizer scene in San Diego got like more developed, I didn't feel like a sense of I didn't feel like I was unwelcome or like intimidated by it or anything. And here it's a little bit like this is not my neighborhood, so I have a little bit of trepidation with just like going up to people and being like, hey, I want to play shows, like, or where are the shows at, or and stuff like that. So yeah, I gotta say I do feel pretty similar with that kind of like weird lack of momentum when it comes to like reaching out and talking to people, and I don't know why. That's kind of an interesting thing.
I think you, I mean, I know people have mentioned it before, but everyone is older and everyone has, a lot of people have had kids like you and are in different parts of their lives. And as much as we don't want to like consider that that's a part of it. We all like, I think everyone has this like idea that, oh, we'll stay, stay young forever, and like the shows will still be happening and whatever. I unfortunately don't know that that's true. And I think that the scene has also, because it's pivoted, or not pivoted, it's evolved. It just looks different than what it was before. I mean, I think that COVID has had a lot more impact on it than, I mean, it has had a massive impact on everything, but for a space, for a scene that relied so much on the intersection between physical and digital spaces, to lose both of those, even if it's for like a year, and to combine that with people exploring other types of music, evolving their life situations, like there's just not enough, like there's no place for a new generation of people to join that community right now, it seems like. And so it's kind of hard to put more gas in the tank. But I think on top of that, I mean, again, to the question of what happened, I think chiptune isn't really viable. Like, so the space that chiptune had for me when I first joined was that it was cheap. It was very cheap to get into, and it was like always with me and all that sort of stuff. That was a re I can't emphasize enough how important that was. Like, I could buy a Game Boy for like $15, and that Game Boy I would get like hundreds of hours out of. When I was living in Japan, I was literally buying boxes of like 40 Game Boys on like Yahoo auctions of, and just this was actually for Anthony, Non-Finite. Anthony would send me like Yahoo auctions, and I would just like buy them and then just ship all the Game Boys off to Anthony. It was like, he's like, oh yeah, grab three or four out of the box before you send it to me. It's like it was so available. And now this, I was just in Tokyo 3 days ago. I went to Super Potato and Bleep and all the retro game stores. You can't find a Game Boy for under like $200 to $300, and like that immediately takes everybody out of the running who would have gotten into Game Boys at a young age, right? Like, you're not going to spend $300 on a Game Boy as a 23-year-old. Are you kidding me? Not to mention when that thing breaks, you can't afford two other Game Boys to use as parts Game Boys. So I don't know. There's like there's no physical space. There's no hard. There's the hardware is not viable, especially when you can just crack Ableton and you have everything that you need. So it's like, I guess the question is like, why would anybody get into chiptune in 2024 when there are so many other options to that are like more user friendly, have better IO. And I think the question, I guess, is not so much like why somebody would get into chiptune. It's that like chiptune just looks different. So why is there a reason why we're still referring to chiptune as this kind of like hardware only? Or are we still thinking of chiptune as just that kind of like hardware focus, like it's made on an Atari ST? Or are we looking at it more like chiptune is kind of everywhere?
Yeah, I mean that's kind of where I've like landed in terms of like my theory that chiptune is a vibe more than anything else these days is it's become, you can take elements of what chiptune was and apply them to like basically any kind of music these days, where it's like the portability and the ease of use and the cheapness is like, that guy making Kendrick Lamar's whole album on his phone or something, right? Like it's something like
That's
that.
chiptune, honestly.
And it's a lot of people could come at me and be like, that then chiptune as a term is like meaningless, but I still do think that there was something there, right? There was something like physical and tangible and real that we could grab onto at the time, and just because it's kind of like dispersed itself into like a bunch of different subgenres and workflows and scenes and people, it doesn't mean that like chiptune wasn't a thing. You know, it's like saying that about techno, right? Techno, everyone calls everything techno now, but like that doesn't mean that Detroit techno didn't exist, right? So I think that like one of the things about this podcast is like trying to figure out what that was. Yeah. Trying to, you know, kind of disentangle that and figure out. And I think, yeah, what you're saying is like, it has changed and it's kind of gone everywhere and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, I think I would be a little sad if it was exactly the same. Like everything always has to change and we have to be comfortable with that. And I think the inevitability of chiptune getting absorbed into the broader like vocabulary of music, I don't know. I'm like, to me, that's to be expected, right? Like I think that's, as sad as it can be, as it is for people who like really were there in the moment and like, you know, really like are super nostalgic for this one moment in time, like it's like what we kind of wanted to happen, which is like chiptune become super big, is like it's true. It's just not in the way that I think anybody really expected, which is like, I mean, there's like some bleeps and bloops on the latest like Taylor Swift album, it's pretty much everywhere because it's because people want to hear it. People like chiptune and people love a square wave. Like it's always going to be, it scratches something in our brains that feels cool. And the further we get away from like people growing up with like with NES and all that, like the less it matters like how it was made or if that person is like dancing on a stage with a Game Boy, and it's more like, does it scratch the brain thing? And is it like fun and enjoyable to listen to? That's not to say that I think the like traditional chiptune is going to go away. I mean, I think people will still perform with Game Boys, and I will perform with Game Boys again. I love doing it, and I will always, but at the same time, I'll always incorporate like chiptune ideas into anything that I make. Like it's you can't take an ARP away from me. But again, but ARPs aren't really pure chiptune either. So I don't know. I think it's a complicated question, but it's one that I think I'm like pretty optimistic about. I think for the people who love the kind of traditional like hardware focus approach, I can imagine there will be more chiptune shows in the future. There are ones happening now. But I think it's cool that like those sounds and ideas will persist and will be more kind of broadly available to everyone. And I think what you said about like, you know, the Kendrick album being produced on a phone, like that is amazing. Like like is chiptune just music with constraints? Like maybe, I don't know. Is it just tracker music? Maybe, I don't know. Maybe like we get lost with the question it's important just to like love and appreciate the chiptune that exists all around us.
Well, that seems like a great place to end it. That was a very kumbaya, like.
Now everybody hold hands. We'll listen to this square wave together.
Yeah. No, that was a good place to end it. So yeah, I wanted to thank you again for coming on the podcast and talking to me about this stuff. You know, I feel like we hit a lot of different things, and yeah, I'm excited to hear more from you. Yeah.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think this project is incredible. As I've told you before, I think it's recording, the act of like recording all these experiences and all these thoughts and feelings, and it's just super vital. It's too easy to just keep on charging ahead. And I think we're all better when we kind of like think about this stuff in actively, and record it however we can. Shouts out to Emily Fetter and to Marjorie Becker for all the recording they've done of past shows, and it's a record that is well worth keeping.
If you'd like to support the show, you can give it a 5-star rating on the podcast platform of your choice. I'd also appreciate it if you shared the show with someone who would find it interesting. Thanks for listening.